Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Jim Garrity is out the rest of the week. Daniel Foster of National Review Online is doing a great job in his stead. And Dan, we have good news, bad news, and crazy news for conservatives. And in a lot of ways, it's good news, bad news, and crazy news for the nation today. I don't even know that there's really a lot of partisanship here, although I'm sure that some on the left would argue that, particularly on the first one here. But right now, Attorney General Eric Holder is testifying, and if I may say so, testifying quite poorly before the House Judiciary Committee. Here's the issue that he's been dealing with so far this morning. Fast and Furious, which we'll get to in the second martini, hasn't even really been a major topic of discussion. I'm sure it will be. But this is from the Washington Times. The top Republican on the House Judiciary Committee, that is Lamar Smith of Texas, said Thursday that the Obama administration is fueling speculation about Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan's impartiality because it won't turn over documents detailing her role in crafting the legal strategy to defend the health care law while she was serving in the administration. Apparently, there's like a Nixonian gap, as Congressman Smith puts it here. There's this whole document trail that somehow vanishes between January 8th and March 5th of 2010. And of course, that's right to the buildup of the actual passage of the legislation, so I'm sure there was no legal concerns or legal work associated with this whatsoever, right? So the fact that this gap exists for a two-month period in the most critical time of the buildup to this law definitely smells fishy, and good for Lamar Smith and these Republicans for holding Eric Holder's feet to the fire. My ultimate guess is they could have footage of her feverishly advocating for the law, and she still wouldn't recuse herself. But still, it's good the Republicans are bringing this to our attention.
Yeah, the funny thing is, this is one of half a dozen scandals so far that Eric Holder has been involved with, and he just seems like the most put upon man in Washington. The sense I get from watching him is that he just doesn't like his job that much, and he didn't really expect it to be political. He thought he could get there, he could go to Washington and continue to do the sorts of things that he always did, advocate civil rights law, things like that. But, you know, there's a Congress you have to deal with. There are any number of criminal investigations that you have to oversee, major complex operations like Fast and Furious, which, as the more I learn about it, people say, oh, well, what did Holder know? I'm not sure he knew anything. This is not exactly the most hands-on attorney general that we've ever seen. And just now, Phil Klein at Washington Examiner put up a story about Jim Sensenbrenner asking Holder if anyone at Justice lied about Fast and Furious. And Holder says, no, nobody lied. And Sensenbrenner says, well, didn't they send inaccurate information to Congress? Didn't they mislead Congress? And Holder says, yes. Sensenbrenner says, what's the difference between lying and misleading Congress? And Holder says, it's a state of mind. I mean, so he's very lawyerly, but there's a lot about this job that he just doesn't get, doesn't care about, or is too incompetent to stay on top of. And the Kagan thing is, you know, it's important for the future of the country that I think that she recuse herself, but I don't suspect it's going to happen. And it's just one of half a dozen sideshows that have befallen Eric Holder's Justice Department, and he just does not seem up to the task.
That's true. And like you said, she probably wouldn't recuse herself because without her, they really have probably no hope of holding this thing up, and they may not anyway. But yeah, folks, this was the good martini of the Republicans holding Eric Holder's feet to the fire. But yeah, Eric Holder is a persistent bad martini. And as a result, let's just make him martini number two as well here, because, you know, we've talked about the Fast and Furious operation, how that went horribly wrong, even if it was designed the way the Justice Department says it was designed, which there are serious questions about that. But now this wasn't just a matter of getting guns into the hands of Mexican drug cartels so they could supposedly be tracked. And then, of course, they ended up being used in the murder of a U.S. Border Patrol agent and dozens of other people in Mexico. Now there's a couple more components to this which make this story even worse, and in the minds of some, substantially worse. First of all, the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, was involved in this as well. And they pretty much tried the same thing with money that the ATF tried with the weapons. They put tens of millions of dollars in the hands of these drug cartels so they could quote-unquote track it. Well, apparently that didn't work very well either. So your taxpayer dollars and mine being used for that. And as it turns out, and Jim reported on this in the Morning Jolt this morning, there's more evidence that one of the real reasons for this program was to actually restrict gun laws in this country. As we've reported here and elsewhere, one of the things that happened here is that the ATF kept telling legitimate law-abiding gun dealers, don't worry about it, just sell them the guns, we'll take care of this as a government operation. But the real plan, apparently, was to go back and say, look, These gun dealers, they sold all these guns to people who shouldn't have been given guns. We have to crack down and register these things and put more restrictions in place. And so this is just exploding in the Democrats' face, and it couldn't be better that it's actually coming to light. But the fact that all of this actually happened and they tried to pull this off is disgusting.
On the first issue, I had thought that the worst use of taxpayer dollars or stimulus funding in the Obama administration was that few million dollars to study monkeys on cocaine,
right.
If you remember that from a couple years back.
Sure.
But now we're actually spending tens of millions of taxpayer dollars to produce and distribute cocaine. So I guess we're cutting out the middleman in a sense there. No, this really is terrible, and it's a great moral test. Are you a means justify the ends kind of guy, or are you sometimes things just aren't right kind of guy? Because even if you think the means justify the ends and you think that it might be important for us to bend the rules a little to find out how weapons or money gets distributed through the cartels, that's not the same thing as 1,000 guns and tens of millions of dollars and you know, essentially being complicit now at this point in the murder of a U.S. Border Patrol agent and who knows how many Mexicans and other innocent people. And on the second thing, I mean, it doesn't get any more cynical. And this is one of my colleagues this morning at the news meeting, Charlie Cook, said, when I first heard people say, oh, Fast and Furious was about gun control, I thought it was just paranoia. I thought maybe we were getting a little too antsy on the right and we were just a little bit paranoid. But, you know, we come to find out it was about gun control, or at least it was exploited to push gun control. And if you read these emails from DEA, it's exactly as you put it. Not only are they strong-arming these dealers or coaxing them into illegally selling guns to people who shouldn't be able to buy them, but then they're entrapping them into their own regulation and limit. It's exactly as you said. I mean, it's a setup from the word go, and it really is outrageous, and it's all on paper.
Well, I wish that was the only outrageous thing we had to talk about in our three martini lunch today, because number three is also quite outrageous, and this is just on paper, but it still sets a tone and a policy and an environment that is just so aggravating to a lot of people. And we're talking about Major Nidal Hassan. He's, of course, the Muslim radical who killed, I believe, 13 people, wounded a few dozen others at Fort Hood, Texas, just about this time in 2009. And the way that the Pentagon, the Defense Department, the Army have gone about trying to classify this has angered a lot of people, including the congressman who represents that district, Congressman Carter in Texas. Basically, the administration has made every possible effort to not say that this is an act of jihad, an act of radical Islam. The latest, as explained by Republican Senator Susan Collins at the Homeland Security Committee in the Senate, is that a letter from the Pentagon has been referenced as workplace violence, Dan. This is not an act of terrorism, even. It's an act of workplace violence. So apparently he was just going postal. The fact that he was tied in with Anwar al-Awlaki, who was apparently an American citizen worthy of targeting in the minds of many, many people because of his radical terrorist leanings and activities. But apparently the fact that this guy acted on the advice and inspiration of said terrorist doesn't make him a terrorist.
One thing I'll say is, if you want to know whether something is done in the name of violent jihad or al-Qaeda or Islam, a good place to look is what the person who's shooting says about it. And in this case, the good major made very clear that he was acting on behalf of and in the name of his religion and in the name of violent Islamic extremism. The real concern about this, and it's just so perverse, calling this an act of workplace violence, it's beyond Orwellian. It's something a little bit different. Mark Stein has been great at NR about this, and he reported on an instance, which may not seem related, but he reported on an instance in which a 9-year-old was suspended for sexual harassment, quote unquote, for kicking somebody in the groin on the playground. Similarly, I wrote in the corner yesterday that another, I think, 8-year-old in North Carolina was suspended for, again, quote-unquote, sexual harassment for calling his teacher cute, an 8-year-old boy. This is the wages of political correctness, calling this workplace violence. These words don't mean anything. And when words don't mean anything, when they're not moored to some common shared reality, and we all understand what each other is talking about, that's really hard to solve any kind of problems. The term sexual harassment doesn't mean anything when it's sexual harassment to be a 9-year-old boy in a playground. The word workplace violence and the word terrorism, the phrase workplace violence and the word terrorism, don't mean anything when you can call what the major did workplace violence, and that's the real danger here: is that we're in danger of not even speaking the same language anymore on really important issues.
And the same reports that have talked about this ridiculous characterization of Hassan's murders as workplace violence talk about how Al-Qaeda and others are actively trying to infiltrate the military to basically carry out similar attacks, similar atrocities, and the fact that the administration is at least publicly turning a blind eye towards this is really disgusting as well. Dan, not a lot of great news today, but it was a good conversation, and we look forward till tomorrow.
Yeah, thank you, Greg.
Daniel Foster of National Review Online in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Friday for the next edition of the Three Martini Lunch.